I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
The story of the UK is an economy that has got real momentum.
What is broken can be repaired. What is ruined can be rebuilt.
UK inflation is becoming much more homegrown.
We have huge potential as an economy in the UK.
This is a time to tell Israel there is a path to peace.
Our plan for the British economy is working, but the work is not done.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Caroline Hepke.
And I'm Lizzie Burden.
Now, we have a big development in the Middle East this morning with the Israeli strike on Iran, feared and now delivered. It's a story we're going to talk about in detail today and what it means for the UK, of course. But also, I want to update you on a story that has other major implications. The police involved in a three-year-long investigation into the SNP's finances. They have charged the former First Minister Nicola Sturgeon's husband, the former party chief executive, Peter Murrell.
Yeah, you'll remember a year ago we reported on him being arrested. It sent shockwaves through Scottish politics. Well, yesterday morning he was taken in for questioning again. Officers, though, say he's no longer in custody, but with legal proceedings now active, there are laws on what we can and can't say. The important thing to note, Caroline, is that the high profile case is coming at a time when the election is on the horizon and the SNP's dominance of Scotland is really in question. Labour overtook the SNP in Scotland, polling for the first time since the region's independence referendum a decade ago. This is according to a YouGov survey last week. So it's really an important story that we'll be following on the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. But one that we're a bit limited in our ability to discuss. And so, to the story that I mentioned, Iran, which has now acknowledged that Israel did do something to it. Iran says a drone strike that failed. Israeli media reports say that it involved missiles, though Israel officially silent on the incident that happened overnight, UK time. Bloomberg learned also this morning from two US officials of this Israeli attack against targets in the west of the country. All of this follows Tehran's drone and missile attack on Israel over the weekend. That, in turn, was retaliation for the bombing of an Iranian consulate in Damascus. It's an unprecedented attack that Iran took out on Israeli soil last weekend. Why is it so important to the UK? Of course, Britain helped to repel that Iranian assault on Israel, along with the United States, of course, France and others. Today, the UK government is stressing the need for de-escalation and moderation in the Middle East whilst recognising Israel's right to defend itself. Here is the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak.
Israel absolutely has the right to self-defence. But as I said to Prime Minister Netanyahu when I spoke to him last week, and more generally, significant escalation is not in anyone's interest. What we want to see is calm heads prevail.
So that was Sunak's response this morning, of course, speaking on the airwaves.
And we were discussing the situation with Lindsay Newman, head of global macro geopolitics at Eurasia Group this morning, speaking to Stephen Carroll and me on Bloomberg Radio.
We've now entered into a new, more precarious phase. Markets are on edge with this geopolitical tension. As we know, over the weekend, Iran launched more than 350 missiles and drones into Israeli territory. Now, overnight, Israel has reportedly responded by sending drones into Iran's Isfahan province, where there is an airbase, some nuclear facilities, some missile facilities. It appears really that it was the airbase that was the target, and that's significant because we know that Iran has, Iran's IRGC leadership has indicated that they may consider a change in policy on nuclear should their nuclear facilities be targeted by Israel. So where we are now, what we know is that the international community, you know, the U.S. certainly did not want to see Israel take any further action. They applied quite a bit of pressure, even if it was behind the scenes, to ensure that restraint was shown. But everybody's waking up this morning with the realization that the volatility and uncertainty in the Middle East is really not going away.
So that was Eurasia Group's Lindsay Newman. And joining us for more analysis now is our EMEA News Director, Rosalind Matheson. Ros, what do you think the intention of the Israeli strike was?
Well, from what we can see so far from what happened, and Israel, of course, is never going to confirm this or not necessarily going to confirm it officially, is it looks like there was a missile strike of some form on this area of Western and Central Iran. It's one of the key cities in that area, and it's also the location of a key military base, Air Force base, but also some of Iran's nuclear facilities. And it does seem the intent was to hit the air base and not the nuclear facilities. And so again, it's in that, we're in that realm of tit for tat calibrated responses, trying to work out how to do something that doesn't in turn invite even further retaliation, that allows them to both say they've done something against each other, but avoids the idea that we're going to end up in a much broader and possibly even more dangerous regional conflict, because even Iran doesn't want that to occur. So what we've got is both sides targeting each other, but trying to game out those strategies where they can say that they've shown their assertiveness without tipping the other one into an even bigger response.
Absolutely. Quite some diabolical dance in a way, isn't it, as the rest of the world watches on. I mean, what about the Iranian response then to the Israeli attack? It does seem to be that they're trying to play it down again in this kind of manoeuvring scenario.
Well, they are. In fact, they're saying that what Israel did was drones and not missiles, and said it was unsuccessful, which, of course, is a narrative that Iran would propagate regardless. But what's interesting is state media today in Iran, state broadcasters, are very much coming out with this message that it's business as usual. They're showing footage of the area, the nuclear site of the city, with traffic going as normal, broadcasting that life really is going on unhindered, and certainly no damage or effect on the nuclear site, as mentioned. And so they're kind of downplaying this. They're not saying that this was a massive strike by Israel, and they're not, there is a bit of rhetoric, of course, about, you know, do we need to respond? But really, they're kind of saying that they view this as done. And it's interesting to see that. That's possibly a message for a domestic audience also. But certainly, again, it's Iran sending that message that even they don't want this to escalate further from here.
Okay, that's interesting. I wonder where the UK is in all of this, because the Foreign Secretary David Cameron met with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Wednesday. Did Israel heed pressure from the UK? Does the UK support these strikes on Iran by Israel?
I mean, the comments we've seen so far from the UK today are, again, just calling for restraint in the Middle East. And I imagine that if the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu isn't really heeding the calls of the US President Joe Biden, he's not going to listen to the UK Foreign Secretary either. But what we have seen is that level of escalating concern from the US, from the UK, from countries in Europe about the situation in the Middle East, about the longer running war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza, the humanitarian situation there, the potential that Israel's going to go into Rafah in the southern part of Gaza, an offensive soon, and of course that potential for a broadening conflict that pulls in other players, potentially even the US. And so you've just got this litany of concern for the UK, from Europe and the US about that. They've moved to say we're going to sanction Iran further. That's possibly to placate Israel to some extent also.
Yeah, and the impact on domestic politics in the UK. I mean, I understand, you know, that the most significant player, obviously, is the United States, and perhaps Cameron's role is far lesser. And yet this could potentially have an impact on domestic politics in the UK. I mean, one, through oil prices, crude prices did spike higher, then they pulled back a little bit this morning. But also Gaza, which has become a hugely difficult political issue, actually, for both the Conservatives and for Labour.
Well, that's right. I mean, Gaza particularly has been very, very fraught. And as you say, not just for the Tory party, for the ruling party, but also for Keir Starmer and his Labour Party, because, you know, traditionally, Labour has taken a strong stance in support of Palestinians and the Palestine question. And it's really, you know, put Labour in a difficult spot because on the one hand, you can see those statements of support for Israel in the aftermath of the October 7 attack by Hamas, which was really an existential moment for Israel and a shock to it. But at the same time, again, the concern about the situation inside Gaza, and the longer this conflict goes on, and particularly again, if we do see Israel at some point soon mount that offensive inside Rafah, that's going to become again quite difficult in terms of the way that politically within the UK the two parties handle it.
Yeah, well, as you both say, it's really impacting domestic politics, the situation in Gaza, but then the tit for tat between Israel and Iran is almost seeming to distract from the humanitarian crisis. How much does that feed into the Gaza situation?
Well, it's interesting today in Israel, what we're seeing on a lot of TV and people calling in, you know, just general public calling in, is they're saying that they support Israel, obviously, in what it does. But they want the Israeli government to remain focused on what they see as the two key things here. And the first one is Gaza, again, because of the aftermath of the October 7 attack on Israel. And the other one is making sure that they're warding off Hezbollah, which is another Iranian-backed group which has been attacking Israel from the north in Lebanon, and they don't want Israel getting distracted by picking a big fight with Iran directly or getting, you know, yet another front for Israel to have to deal with. And so it's clear within Israel that people want the focus to be on Gaza, and the support there really is quite high for a military move into Rafah in the near term, possibly not during Passover, which is coming for Israel, but in the aftermath of that.
Yeah, when people travel also to visit people a lot within Israel, a holiday moment in Israel. The other, I mentioned that it is a diabolical dance between Israel and Iran, and I say that because of the nuclear implications. The UK has been deeply involved with the US and others, you know, trying to curtail Iran's nuclear weapons program, which was sort of admitted to in a way for the first time by a senior commander, Iranian commander, sort of referenced to it, as it were, this week. I mean, again, how is the UK and allies, the US and so on, thinking about the nuclear weapons program, the threat there?
Well, it's been interesting again because we didn't see the nuclear facilities targeted today, although Israel has warned that that was one of the scenarios, that's one of the possibilities. And Iran's nuclear program has been long running and very contentious, including with the UK. You know, Iran says that its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes. Others say that it's been using it to build a nuclear arsenal. And we saw, of course, the breakdown of the deal on its nuclear program under the Trump administration. That was putting some guardrails, really, around what Iran could do while allowing it to produce nuclear fuel, obviously, for energy purposes. And the breakdown of that has really allowed Iran to proceed somewhat unfettered in its program. And really, for the UK and the US, the question is, at some point, do they try and resume that deal, at least to put guardrails around what Iran is doing? Is that completely off the table, at least politically, in the US going into an election cycle with the presidential election later this year? But it's certainly something that, in the event, especially, that something happens to Iran's nuclear facilities, whether it's Israel or something else, then we're certainly very much in uncharted territory.
Something I'm sure we'll return to on the podcast. Our EMEA News Director, Roslyn Matheson, we thank you for joining us.
Ros, thank you so much for your time.
Well, if in 2016 elections were all about Twitter, in 2024 politicians are battling to dominate TikTok. It's far too cool for us, Caroline, so we're going to bring in an expert. We've got personal finance influencer Timothy Paul, who's also known as Temper Time on his social channels, where he gives advice on everything from mortgages to investing. Timothy recently sat down with the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, to discuss the spring budget. So, Timothy, welcome to the Bloomberg UK Politics podcast. It's good to have you on. You're far cooler than us. But look, when Rishi Sunak wore sambas, immediately the internet branded him uncool. I wonder what possessed you to do this collaboration, given the risk of being cancelled?
That is a very good question. And to be honest, my response would be I didn't actually think about that at the time. I thought about what an opportunity to go from making videos in my bedroom to getting the chance to sit down with the Prime Minister for even just 5 minutes, which it was. I thought there is nothing that's going to stop me from doing that. So I blocked out my schedule, called my mum and my dad, and I was like, yeah, I'm going to number 10. Can't wait. And to be honest, it was a great chat. I had a lot of fun. So yeah, I think it was a good chance, a good opportunity. That something like that, I think, surprised that it came about for someone like me. So I wasn't worried about the cancel culture, as it were.
Look, it is extraordinary. Listen, you are in a very lucky position. It's the sort of interview that you know, traditional MSM journalists like myself maybe would really love to do as well. Look, the Prime Minister, though, what do you think his aim was in kind of, it was a number of influencers, of finfluencers. Why do you think he called on you? What do you think that you can, I suppose, give to the Prime Minister? Because he's got his own social channels that he's quite fond of sticking videos up on. Why do you think it's so important to have you guys in the room?
Yeah, I think it's probably a case of him and Number 10 realizing that there's a wider audience out there of young people who can't be necessarily reached by, you know, traditional forms of I guess, you know, the TV and radio and you know, just standard kind of news. So they call upon someone like, you know, myself and Abby and who is there to, who has that audience, I guess, the attention of the younger generation at the moment, you know, especially from like 18 and up to like 25, 26. I think it's, I guess, an appreciation of maybe the voices that we have on social media, and I guess the platforms that we've managed to build.
I'm really curious what it was like. I'm just really curious what it was like in the room, how it went down in Downing Street. Did you have all the 20-something special advisors breathing down your neck as you created the content?
There was a few people in the room, yeah, more than I was expecting. but it was all actually very, very laid back. It was, even in terms of like the timings and stuff, like they were like, if you go slightly over the 5 minutes, it's fine. There was a couple cameras, a couple of, you know, I guess, special advisors hanging around the room. And then obviously Rishi and myself, we did it in what is called the White Room in Downing Street, where they do most of the filming. It was all quite surreal. I think, to be honest, like, I hardly remember what happened. It wasn't until I watched it back and I was like, oh, I don't even remember saying that. but it was I guess probably more laid back than I thought, is what I would say.
Okay. Look, I've got to ask, the other thing is also, and it's an issue that's come up with finfluencers in different ways, but about whether you were paid for it, whether there was a lot of oversight in terms of the content that you put out there, like the crossover between, you know, between it being your own opinion and the access and so on. I mean, were you paid?
I was not paid. No, I was not paid. I would have paid to do this opportunity.
Do you vote Tory? Are you a conservative?
I'm not a conservative myself. I don't really discuss my political stances, because I'm all about education and awareness. Mm-hmm. And I never want to be labeled as somebody who has an agenda. My only agenda is to spread education and to help. So I feel like if I were to discuss things like what my political stance is, that can turn off or turn on people, but I don't want to turn anyone off. I don't want to, you know, whether I'm a Tory or Labour or whichever, I don't want to be pushing an agenda other than, you know, free education.
So has your audience reacted positively to the content?
In all fairness, I would say that the reaction was pretty positive overall. There was inevitably some there was some negative comments, I guess, mostly towards the Sambas, I have to say. but in general, I guess kind of people that maybe are not happy with the way things are at the moment in the country, you know, what's going on, cost of living. So there was some comments around that. But overall, I think the reaction I got personally was a lot of congratulations, a lot of messages and people kind of reaching out saying that's like really cool that you got to do that. So yeah, that's what I focus on and I appreciated that.
Yeah, I mean, in the content, you talked to the Prime Minister about various personal finance issues, things that are important to young people, including, for example, first-time buying. I wonder what you feel, what was the message that you were trying to get across then to the audience from the interaction and from your discussions with the Prime Minister? What do you think they took away from it? Because as I say, your kind of bread and butter is effectively trying to give people personal finance advice kind of aimed at young people.
Yeah. So, well, with the first time buyer question, the reason I asked that is because it's something that me and my partner have been saving to do. And thankfully this year we managed to buy a house. But it's so difficult for a lot of young people to do that now. And I get that a lot in from my audience and from the content that I put out when I make, you know, videos about mortgages. There's such a disconnect between the people that want to get on the ladder and the people that actually are. Because of how difficult it is. So I just wanted to ask, like, why was there nothing in the budget about that? Because it is difficult. And I was hoping, I think a lot of people were expecting that there would be something maybe to do with the lifetime ISA, but obviously there wasn't. So I just wanted to get his take on what he thinks about the way things are and maybe if there would be something in the future, you know, that would be done, or a new scheme or an enhancement to the lifetime ISA, something like that. I thought it would be something that my audience would be very interested to hear about.
Well, for policymakers listening, what do you get the sense from your audience are things that young people want any government to do for them in this cost of living crisis?
The first thing on the home buying situation is the lifetime ISA cap. I think it would benefit a lot of people if that were to be raised. At the moment, I think you can only use the lifetime ISA if it's on a property up to 450,000. And given that property prices are so high, I think that it would be great if they did raise that. And I know that's something I think Martin Lewis mentioned, the government would consider potentially doing so. That would definitely be one thing, I would say.
Yeah. And just in terms of, you know, all of your followers, there's a big question mark about the general election, about what sort of turnout there is going to be. You know, there's question marks about whether it's going to be fought entirely on the cost of living issue, on the economy, and whether enough people are going to turn out to vote, especially, I guess, if it's going to be a winter election. How turned on, how switched on are your audience about voting, not just kind of thinking about their finances, thinking about maybe first time buying or tax cuts or ISAs, but actually voting on those issues and taking it to the ballot box?
I think it's a good question. It's difficult to really it's difficult to say, I think, especially a lot of what I talk about, I think it would probably be more kind of general topics. So if I make a video about mortgages or tax or whatnot, there's not a lot where I'm talking specifically about the race to number 10 and what the Tories are doing. And I mean, I talk about what the government is doing at the time, but I think I wouldn't really have too much insight into how likely people are to vote and how strongly they feel about it, to be honest.
Well, your expertise is content creation, but it's not Rishi Sunak on his own who's trying to become a bit of an influencer. We're seeing lots of politicians and central bankers dipping a toe into the waters of TikTok. What's your advice to them when they're trying to conquer social media in 2024?
I think the main thing I would say is you have to be you have to be a little bit different. I think the politicians give themselves a bad name for tiptoeing around questions, not really getting to the point, and everything always seems so proper and perfect when it comes across on TV, and it can rub people up the wrong way. With social media, it's an opportunity to really strip it back. And you know, you can have a video where I'm literally just sat here talking to the camera with no script, and it's completely informal, and that can reach a million people within 2 days. And I think what social media brings is a massive additional layer of authenticity, where people that are themselves, people that really, really care about what they're saying, mean what they say, and have, you know, it's something genuine to talk about, that's what does best on social media. That's what I always find. So I think that any politician that is trying to connect with, especially the younger audience on social media, it's, I guess the advice is to rip up the scripts and all of the perfect, you know, the way that things come across. It, I think, just make it more genuine, just make it informal, make it casual. That's I think the best way to approach it.
I mean, I suppose my question to that is, I get the, you know, the authenticity, the thing that cuts across on social media. The bit that sometimes concerns, and I think it like concerns regulators about influencers and stuff, is you know, the take up of like cryptocurrency, of advertising certain things online, and of a kind of trying to help retail investors with really difficult decisions with kind of short social media sort of bites. It's really dangerous territory, I think, for some. And I wonder what you kind of think about that. I guess being an influencer dealing with, you know, complicated financial issues, quite hard to kind of get that balance right, you know. And obviously you can't kind of give people financial advice in that straightforward a way. How do you kind of navigate that?
It's a learning process, definitely. Over time you start to realize, I think at the start I maybe didn't realize how much power my voice carries. So a lot of the content I make now, it's, if I make a video about investing, I'm never going to say to my audience, invest in this because it's great. Even if I make a recommendation, the likelihood is a lot of people are going to act upon the recommendation without doing their own research and considering, is it right for me and their personal situations? It can be a sense of, you do get kind of blind followers. So it's always about educating people so that they have more information after your video than they did at the start. So I might talk about some of the different investing funds that are out there, rather than necessarily saying, this is the best one, do this. It's about educating people on what is out there, what options are available. I think that's the best way to approach it. And in terms of regulation, I think all industries, they need regulators, because you get those that try to abuse, and they, I guess, ruin the fun for the people like me who try and be authentic and genuine and actually want to help. So I think slowly, you know, from when I started to where I am now, there's so much more regulation. There's so much more that goes in when you do a brand deal, when you work with brands. There's a lot that the brands need to consider to make sure that, you know, things are above board. And in line with like ASA guidelines and all different things like that, and the FCA. So more is, I think, as people realize how big the space is getting, and content creation is only growing, social media is only growing, and the number of users is growing, I hope that the regulation grows with it.
All right, Timothy Paul, aka Temper Time, on social channels. Lovely to have you on the program. Thank you.
Yeah, look, something lighter and just interesting to end the programme on, you know, what this general election is going to be all about. I mean, is it going to be about young people? We've talked a lot about the generational divide in terms of finances, getting on the property ladder. I mean, lucky guy to get the invitation into number 10, though.
I can see you green with envy, Caroline.
I kind of am.
But 'twas ever thus, wasn't it? An influencer back in the day would have been Blur or a celebrity. And it's always been about about getting the young vote on side. You've just got to get them out to the ballot box.
Lizzie, I remember Blair walking into number 10 as well. So yeah, look, that's it from us for today. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe. Give it 5 stars so that other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
This episode was produced by James Wilcock and Tiwa Adebayo, and our audio engineer was Sean Guastamacchia. I'm Lizzie Burden.
And I'm Caroline Hepke. We'll be back with more next week. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.